Our last case is 10-1570, State ex rel Gary Ziegler, Stark County Treasurer, versus Jamie Albrighton, Stark County Treasurer. Mr. Nakin?
Thank you, Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court. My name is Matthew Nakin, and I, along with my co-counsel, Patrick O'Hara, represent the relator, Gary Ziegler. I respectfully request 3 minutes for rebuttal time. Thank you. The issue presented for review today is whether a writ of quo warranto should issue to oust respondent Alexander Zumbar from the office of Stark County Treasurer as a result of the commissioners unlawfully removing relator Ziegler from his office and that post. Relator asserts that removing Gary Ziegler from the public office pursuant to section 321.38 of the Ohio Revised Code was repealed or was otherwise facially invalid as being in conflict with Article 2, section 38 of the Ohio Constitution, and thus did not vest the commissioners with authority to so remove him. In 1912, the people of this state adopted revisions to the Ohio Constitution, which included Article 2, Section 38, that required specifically that the removal of any public officer be upon complaint and hearing. The removal statute used here, Section 321.38, is unconstitutional because it conflicts with Article 2, Section 38, because it makes no provision for complaint or hearing, but instead requires nothing more than the pure discretion of three county commissioners.
But there was a complaint in this case, and there was an opportunity for a hearing, although your client declined that opportunity. Why would not a combination of reading the statute together, a complaint in court, setting forth the grounds, a hearing before the county commissioner based in part on that complaint, although the complaint didn't ask for an ouster, why would that not be sufficient compliance with the constitutional provision?
Several reasons, Your Honor. First of all, the reading of a statute in pari materia is generally only applied where the statute is ambiguous. Here, we're dealing with a removal statute, and a removal statute is generally strictly construed. In addition, constitutional challenges don't create ambiguities within a statute, and we submit that this statute's abundantly clear. The statute very clearly provides the discretion to the commissioners to remove Gary Ziegler. The problem is it conflicts with Article 2. Now, to address your Honor's direct question as to whether it should be read in pari materia, I submit that the answer is no. But even if it does, it doesn't help. Where I disagree with Your Honor is that there was a complaint here.
Well, I'm not taking a position, right. So.
There's a document. What I will submit is there's a document, and it's called complaint. In fact, it's Exhibit K in the original exhibits. The problem, when you start reading words into statutes that aren't actually there, is that it creates illogical conclusions. The illogical conclusion here is the argument advanced by the respondent that the complaint in an action pursuant to 321.37, which very specifically authorizes and directs the county to pursue relief against the treasurer who fails to turn over funds, can constitute an Article 2, Section 38 complaint. Exhibit K to the joint exhibits is very clear. There are six causes of action, and every one of them asks for $2,950,000 against somebody. It's either against Gary Ziegler, against the wrongdoer, against an insurer, or against somebody else. What the complaint is, it's a complaint for money damages. It is in no way a complaint that uses the word removal, alleges any act of negligence, alleges any impropriety on behalf of Gary Ziegler.
Isn't that the gist of the removal statute, though, and the removal action, that there was money due from the treasurer for wrongful conduct in the treasurer's office, and it wasn't paid, and it was, as I believe I read, it was served along, this complaint was served along with the notice from the county commissioners that they were going to have a hearing on the removal.
No, Your Honor. They're two different items. The complaint was filed in late July 2010 and is simply a recovery action. It didn't accompany or was it ever associated with in any fashion any notice provided to the relator. What happened is once the complaint was filed, a one-sentence letter was sent to Mr. Ziegler, which are included in the joint exhibits, and said nothing more than, on this date, the county commissioners will be meeting to discuss the treasurer's office. The Article 2, Section 38 requirement of a complaint is very specific. You must notify. The entire purpose behind the constitutional provision is to notify the public official for which you're seeking to remove him what you're claiming they did wrong. And when you fail to do that and you merely say, well, look at the complaint for money damages, we're suing you because you were his boss, but you don't identify any reason or a basis for removal, you do not provide any opportunity to Mr. Ziegler to provide a defense because he doesn't even know what the charges are. Essentially, what happened here is he was provided with a letter, said, come to the commissioner's office. We're gonna address issues regarding the treasurer's office. And he's supposed to come and present witnesses and defend what? They haven't notified him of anything other than the contention that they regard that he owes them money.
Counsel, so that we can understand the procedural posture, the commissioners sent him a letter demanding payment for the funds that were missing at the hands of an employee.
Correct.
And did they specify a time in which payment by the treasurer or the bond companies was to be made? Was there a deadline?
No, I believe they knew that a public servant in the treasurer's office didn't have $2.96 million.
Yeah, but no, did they put a deadline on it?
No.
So they just said, here's the amount that's missing, pay it into the treasury.
Correct.
And they sent that to your client?
Correct. In fact, within
and
the
did
same
they
letter,
send it to the bond companies as well, or anybody
that
else?
Letter wasn't sent to the bond companies. The bond companies received the same complaint that was filed in late July.
So what they called a complaint, you essentially would call a notice to pay.
No, Your Honor, they're actually, what they're calling a complaint wasn't the letter. That's not what they're referring to as the complaint here. In fact, that complaint wouldn't qualify as a complaint under the new statute, Revised Code 3.07 and 3.10, because they specifically state within the letter, you did not commit any blameworthy act resulting in the loss of public funds. What they're referring to as the complaint followed the letter from the prosecutor. It was the actual civil action that was filed pursuant to 321.37, in which they asked for money from a multitude of parties, which included Gary Ziegler.
And that was filed where?
That was filed in the Stark County Court of Common Pleas.
All right. And that was filed when?
That was filed in late July of 2010, I believe July 28th, 30th, somewhere in there.
And then they convened a meeting in August?
They notified, essentially what happened is they notified Gary Ziegler through a letter that said, I believe the first one was we're meeting on August 2nd. Understand, the letter asking him for $2.9 million is sent July 27th, I believe.
Right.
I believe the complaint's filed a day or two after that.
Right.
And then he gets a notice that says, come on to a meeting. We're going to have a hearing.
The answer time hasn't even run on the complaint in the county police court, right?
In fact, Your Honor, the answer time still hasn't run on the complaint.
All right.
So we're at the very infancy of that litigation.
And the notice to come to the commissioner's office, did it set forth the removal statute?
Say that one more, ask me that.
Did the notice to the treasurer to come to the commissioner's office for a meeting set forth that the subject matter for discussion was going to be the removal statute.
It merely said the topic, the first one merely said the topic of discussion was going to be the status of the treasurer's office. Can't prepare a defense to that.
All right.
Don't know what the status of the treasurer's office meant.
At no time was he given written notice that they were going to consider removing him under the statute.
There was a written, essentially procedurally what happened is a motion for temporary restraining order was filed. And what and the Judge Enderle
by
us.
In
what had happened is
in,
I'm sorry?
Filed where?
Filed in the Stark County Court of Common Pleas.
All right.
Asking for the judge to prevent a meeting of the commissioners because the commissioners essentially had announced their intentions to the newspapers. It was pretty widely recognized what they intended to do.
So he was never given formal notice that the meeting was to consider his removal under the statute.
There was.
But he was given notice through news accounts.
There ended up being a third notice issued on August 18th,
right,
stating that there's going to be another meeting. And essentially what they were trying to do was time the judge's rulings on the motions for temporary restraining order. So on August 18th, they issued a third notice. That third notice was a little bit more detailed, and it did notify that they were going to consider removal of Treasurer Ziegler. The problem was they still didn't provide him with a complaint. They're left here trying to argue that the civil action complaint is the complaint. Well, we certainly never had any expectation that we would have to try the issues in the civil action, which have a host of defenses, including potential third-party liabilities. We don't know whether there's going to be a shortfall yet. We certainly, the county never said that their basis for seeking removal was, in fact, that there was a shortfall in Gary Ziegler owed it.
And if the complaint that was filed in Stark County Common Pleas is in fact the notice, they haven't had an education yet that they can remove him, have they?
I absolutely agree with that. There's been, as far as we're concerned, as this court held in Hull versus Brown, and I think that's probably the logical progression at this point, Hull versus Brown says very clearly that a statute that does not a removal statute that does not incorporate into the words the Article 2, Section 38, meaning that there is complaint in hearing, is by itself unconstitutional and means nothing. Hull versus Brown was decided in 1922, 10 years after that statute was put in place. This statute was already in place.
Counsel, what I'm trying to get to is, how much notice and with what degree of specificity had been served on your client prior to the date that the commissioners actually held the removal meeting and removed your client from office pursuant to the statute?
Right. Other than the fact that they were meeting, we had 4 days' notice of their intention to remove him, which, Your Honors, we submit is violative and certainly short of that required under 3.08.
And based on that, I assume on your advice, you and your client opted not to attend that hearing.
Actually, Your Honor, it's beyond that. It's not that we didn't, the shortfall of notice was one reason. The primary reason is we submit that the Board of County Commissioners has no jurisdiction to decide the removal of Gary Ziegler because the statute was facially unconstitutional and overruled in Hull versus Brown.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, in terms of the remedy being requested here, the fact that Mr. Zumbar now has been elected, was the third successor basically, and has been elected by the voters of the county to this office.
Right.
Does that in any way weaken the argument that the office is being unlawfully held by someone else and your client is entitled to be reinstated?
It actually strengthens it, Your Honor, and it strengthens it because the argument is simply the Board of Commissioners here usurped the will of the people when they ousted Gary Ziegler in violation of the Constitution. The will of the people was usurped then. Anything that came after that is unlawful. And because Gary Ziegler's still within his term, were certainly entitled to quo warranto relief. Your Honors, I'm running short on rebuttal time, so what I'd like to do is simply conclude and ask that this court determine that Mr. Ziegler was unlawfully removed and permit find that Alex Zumbar unlawfully holds that office and reinstate him for the balance of his elected term. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Rhodes.
Chief Justice O'Connor, Justices of the Court, Counsel, may it please the Court, my name is Ross Rhodes. I'm an assistant prosecuting attorney in Stark County on behalf of the respondent. The relator has brought a constitutional challenge which brings a great deal of jurisprudence of this court into play. A statute in Ohio is presumed to be constitutional. Legislatures adopting a statute are presumed to intend that it be executed and applied in keeping with constitutional provisions. And I'll begin with that this court, as a general rule, will not reach a constitutional determination if it is not necessary to the case. We submit.
Counsel, just help me understand where you're coming from in terms of your position. Are you claiming that the complaint that was filed in the Stark County Common Pleas Court is the complaint that meets the constitutional provision?
Alternatively, yes. That in looking at the words of the statute, it requires that a suit be instituted, and that can only be done
by
complaint.
That complaint has not been heard and not been resolved. So how do you get from filing that complaint to a hearing that you alleged happened that is nowhere in the four corners of the Court of Common Pleas or the complaint process?
The hearing is mandated by the Constitution, and by allowing the commissioners the discretion, and that was a change in the law from commissioners shall remove the treasurer to commissioners may remove the treasurer.
So therefore, you're maintaining you can file a common pleas court complaint and then have a hearing based on that complaint in an office in another jurisdiction with different parties, with the commissioners as the hearing officers, not the trial court that has the complaint sitting in front of it.
It is not a hearing on the complaint in the sense that the Common Pleas Court is going to have a hearing on the complaint. It is a complaint that alleges that public money has been not accounted for, and as this court is aware, that is a strict liability.
Okay, do you maintain that at least the third letter that seemed to be a little more specific, according to him, is that the official complaint, or is the one you filed in Common Pleas the complaint?
Our position has been that the initial complaint filed in Common Pleas Court satisfies the Constitution. The trial court in ruling on the constitutionality also acknowledged that the notices that were given to served on the relator in connection with this proceeding, the last one being a two-page detailed recitation of what would be considered, was also a satisfaction of the constitutional requirement of the due process that is due to this office.
And you maintain that the 4 days you gave him to appear and defend was sufficient?
In the circumstances, it was. The theft had been discovered approximately 14 months prior. There had been a long process where the state auditor had been examining the books and accounts of the county treasurer, which the county treasurer was involved in to some extent and was given an opportunity to review before it was filed. The complaint in the Common Pleas Court set out very simply, the money is missing, it is owed to the state. The all of that is what is being determined. The statement that the initial notifications of hearing did refer to the action that was pending under 321.37. So it was to consider the status of the treasurer's office in light of the pending action under 321.37. So with that, the final notice, if we will call it the final notice on August 18th, which was received on August 18th, was quite sufficient notice to the relator of what was going to be determined, what he was going to have to the conditions of the treasurer's office that he was going to be asked to answer for.
I'm sorry, I missed the exigent circumstances. This had been going on for 14 months. There had been, I don't believe there's any allegation that Mr. Ziegler stole the money.
None.
And so the necessity for doing this with a four-day notice was what? Because I'm not following your logic there.
We're not arguing exigent circumstances. The trial court...
It was reasonable to only give him 4 days' notice, so I'm assuming that there was some urgency within which to do this in 4 days.
No, I was suggesting that the knowledge that he had, officially beginning with the filing of the Auditor of State's special audit report on June 25th, which sets out the missing money, and that is all that is involved
if
here.
If the only basis was that as the elected treasurer, he was ultimately responsible on a strict liability standard, and there was no belief that he was culpable or no evidence that he was culpable in the theft, what was the urgency of moving forward without proceeding through the trial court?
There were no exigent circumstances. It was a matter of the public trust and the taxpayer money that had been entrusted to him and would be continued to be entrusted to him on a daily basis.
Counsel, who's going to, if this ultimately is concluded, and there's a finding, obviously, that the money has been stolen, and is there a bonding company that will allow for the recovery to the county?
The relator has acknowledged that the money is missing and that he cannot repay it. The statute requires under 32137 that suit be brought against the treasurer and the sureties. That was done. Here we have two surety companies, one for each term, because this theft took place over approximately 6 years by the chief deputy treasurer. So there are now two bonding companies. They are also named as defendants in the lawsuit.
And is there sufficient coverage under the bonds to make the county whole?
No, there is not. The bonds are for $250,000 each. The missing funds unaccounted for are $2.94 million.
This may not be particularly germane to the legal issues, but I didn't become aware of the fact that a treasurer was personally liable until we had a school case.
Yes.
Why would anybody want to be a treasurer with that sort of exposure? I can't fathom why anybody in this state would want to be a treasurer after this.
It has come up in discussion. This court has previously acknowledged that the rule can be harsh. A previous treasurer of state, this court acknowledged that he'd be forced into bankruptcy. Could face at least a judgment that he could never pay off for the rest of his life for having had no involvement in the loss of the funds. It is a harsh rule. It is a rule that goes back to common law.
Suppose there's a legislative fix, if there are any.
I'm afraid it is a legislative matter.
Counsel, like Justice Lansinger, I'm a little concerned about the remedy in this matter and the procedural posture. There's been an entire election, and contested election, as I understand it, in this case.
That's correct.
Which involves quite a bit of effort. There was no effort to expedite the decision in this case to prevent that sort of thing occurring with this legal cloud hanging over it. And I'm just wondering, does latches apply in this case in any way? Because all this was allowed to continue, and now a lot of people have, you know, acted to their potential detriment.
Yes, Your Honor.
On this.
We do take the position that the relator has not preserved his position and has, in fact, allowed a great deal of water to go under the bridge. He sought the initial stay in the trial court, which was denied. That was on the morning of August 23rd. The hearing was on the afternoon of August 23rd, but the Court of Appeals for the Fifth District is in Canton, Ohio. A stay could have been sought. It was not. The appeal was filed that Friday, 4 days later, after the decision had been made, but before the appointed successor had qualified for office. After that, the central committees of the counties the one party nominated an interim who was allowed again to qualify for office and take office without any action on the part of the relator, filed an action in this court on September 7th without seeking any kind of a stay of any of these proceedings. The candidates were nominated for a general election in November. They were certified by the County Board of Elections, and the election went forward. 54% of the voters of Stark County elected the man who is now Stark County Treasurer and is now a respondent in this action. We certainly say that that is not in keeping with his duty of affirmative action, as this court has put it in the Newell case, to take steps to preserve his rights to the office that he claims that he has been usurped from.
When did he file here?
September 7th, I believe.
That was how many days after the decision?
That was about 2 weeks.
2 weeks after the decision. So in your opinion, the fact that he filed an appeal also required him to file a stay?
He could have sought judicial intervention in two ways, with the appeal of the trial court's decision, which he did appeal but did not seek a stay, and with this court's original jurisdiction in quo warranto.
Do we have any case law that says when you file a quo warranto to remove an officer, a public official, that you claim you have that right to that seat, that there is also a requirement that you file for a stay?
There's case law in the cases cited in the Newell case. The general rule that is developed in civil service law is if you file your quo warranto action before the your claimed usurper becomes permanent, that is sufficient notice to prevent it from becoming permanent.
This was an interim, so it wasn't permanent. This was an interim appointment, so it wasn't permanent, was it?
It was not permanent. There was first interim appointment by the commissioners, second interim appointment by the central committee, and then there was an election. All of that was allowed to happen without any intervention, and the court has looked at circumstances and say, in other circumstances, simply filing the quo warranto may not be enough.
Counsel, I recall when I first saw this case, when it actually got in front of our eyes, and there was a process internal to us also, thinking, while I have written from time to time opposing the imposition of latches in elections matters, that this was a classic latches, what the discussion's just been about here. But I think, and I haven't gone back over it in the last few days, after I pursued that thought, it appeared that there had been prompt and timely action by the former treasurer all along the way to contest what had happened to him by appealing to the, by having a assigned judge address this, by filing an original action in a timely manner here, and by pursuing it on all levels. Is there a stay on a court of appeals case right now on the same issue?
Only a stay in deference to this court's consideration.
Right. So I think when one, in fairness to him, when one goes through all of that, he has not exactly slept on his rights. He has pursued actively other than your statement, well, he could have asked for stays, the probability of getting that. When one is raising, his argument is the statute is unconstitutional, or it's unconstitutional as it's applied to him. Which is it? Which are you having to defend here in your view? It's unconstitutional on its face, or it's unconstitutional as applied?
Well, they actually don't end up being all that different, because on its face means that there are no circumstances in which this statute can be applied constitutionally. We have before us a situation in which it was applied constitutionally, and because it is a statute that is adopted after the constitutional provision, it is presumed to be intended to have been applied constitutionally, and therefore it is not reading anything into the statute other than the Constitution. You're not reading words into this statute, you're reading the Constitution into the statute. But having said in his position that all of this is unconstitutional, it is our position that it is insufficient to simply announce that and sit back, say, oh, I will not participate in the hearing, I will not appeal the hearing, which could have been appealed and the constitutional issue could have been raised.
Let me ask you a question
appeal.
About
yes.
that, Mr. Rhodes, if you would. Can you educate me as to the statutory requirements for a showing of culpability on the part of the treasurer in order to proceed or to seek a removal of an office holder, elected official?
Relator talks about the general removal of an office holder, 3.07, and it is all fault-based. It is moral turpitude. It is dishonesty, drunkenness.
I believe the suggestion is that those go to the personal involvement of the elected official or the office holder. Facts here seem to indicate that the office holder is exonerated from any participatory or even knowledge of this theft, and it was done by employees and secreted from him. So is there an issue, or what does the statute say with respect to removal when there is no personal culpability?
Under 321.37 and 321.38, his culpability does not arise. It is a matter of he was entrusted with public funds and cannot pay it. Money is missing, he cannot account for. Under 3.07, it is all fault-based, and under the prior statute that was considered repealed by the whole court, it was an embezzlement that had been found. So you have a criminal charge with a mandatory removal, and the court obviously had very great difficulties with that. What we are dealing with here is the essence of a treasurer's office, which is to receive public money, taxpayer money, and to safeguard it so that it is paid out in accordance with law. If the treasurer cannot do that, the treasurer is not doing the treasurer's job. And we're not talking fault, we're not talking personal gain, we're not talking embezzlement, we are talking about inability to account for public funds.
Thank you, Mr. Rhodes.
Thank you.
Mr. Nakin, you've used your time, but you may take a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. To address very quickly this issue about stay, Judge Inderlead was appointed by this court as special counsel. We were not physically in Stark County, Ohio. We were all in our offices, and I believe he was in Canada on August 23rd. He issued a ruling over the phone. The actual ruling, the written ruling, didn't even come in until much later. The ruling came in at approximately 10:30 or 11 o'clock, and I believe the scheduled hearing was at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. We made an oral request for a stay to Judge Inderlead. It was denied. There was physically not time to file a notice of appeal in the Court of Appeals and attempt to get a ruling on it. We'd have had to drive to Canton, which is about 2 hours from where we are, get into a courthouse, get the judge, and then hopefully have time before they met to oust him. The ouster had already occurred and it was over. Secondly, and most important, we submit that Hull versus Brown has already determined that Article 2, Section 38 has rendered this statute a nullity. This statute's existed in the law for 170 years. It does not provide the words complaint and hearing. Therefore, just as this court decided in Hull versus Brown, which we're asking the court to do the exact same thing, is to determine that what has already been done in 1912 repealed this statute, because the statute was already on the books in the form of then as General Code Provision 2696. This law, in its exact same form, there's been no change. Mr. Rhodes suggested there was some change in the law that somehow determined that the legislature had cleaned up the law. Absolutely false. The exact words may have been in this statute, and the substantive statute's been the same since at least 1841. No change. Thank you, Your Honors.
You will be notified of our decision. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Marshal, would you adjourn court?